So this is a case that you all had a chance to take a look at. The case was written by Jerry Sherman. Unfortunately, Jerry is unable to be with us today, but I do want to kind of go over Jerry's background, since he's the one who wrote this case and actually is the one who lived through it. Jerry Sherman is the founder of Pathway Advisors. It's a corporate turnaround advisory firm for family-controlled and owner-driven lower-middle-market companies. Jerry has been on the board of four companies, and he currently sits on the board of a federally funded commercial mortgage lender. He's an active author, has written for publications including Family Business Magazine, Journal of Corporate Renewal, and Commercial Lending Review. In October of 2019, Jerry published the book Untapped, Capturing Your Company's True Potential. And right now he's in the process of writing a couple of chapters dealing with COVID-19. Jerry holds BS and MA degrees from Boston University. So I'm sorry Jerry can't be here. I'm Larry Steibel of Board Options, and I'm just going to be moderating the discussion. The panel was put into groups of three to discuss the case. So I'm going to start with Freddie. Freddie, can you discuss what your group came up with, or just forward to the moderator? To the group chair.
Sure. We had decided to have Jerry present, but you know, I'll take a stab at it.
Please.
Jerry and Joe, if you guys want to jump in, that'll be perfectly fine. So I'm going from memory here. What we basically identified was that, and I believe his name is Mark, right?
Yeah.
George Marks needs to have an off-site conversation with Fifth and lay out to him and incentivize him to make a pivot to invest in this new technology, that he should use the capital that he's earned with helping the company become stable to invest in what is transformative technology, because if he doesn't do that, it's probably pretty sure that absolute their company will become obsolete in the future. Who knows what that timetable
will be. Okay.
But at the same time, realizing that Fifth is not the type of individual that you're going to be able to bring that type of information to in a board meeting. So hopefully get his buy-in on the front end. We also talked about the position of the attorney, and that maybe it's time to move on to a more effective attorney at this time, so that they can have some more legal guidance, even if that means pivoting to Ann Alford. We also, and hopefully I'm not stealing everyone's thunder, thought about maybe it's time to become a little more equitable in the ownership of the firm, to give Ann a little more incentive to participate in a more positive manner by breaking it down from 60-40 to a 50-50 split. And then lastly, and Joe and Jerry, add in it as you feel, we felt maybe that Sixth is not really the right person to be the CEO, and that we should really consider hiring an outside CEO. Hence why we take the strategy of having a conversation with Fifth outside of the board meeting, so that we can have that hard conversation, because he's definitely not the type of individual that would probably be real receptive in the boardroom with such a dynamic change to their current family business.
How would you get him to buy into what your plan?
Well, you know, we talked about what's important to him, and what's important to him is the longevity and the continuance of the company, and to pass it on to his son, Sixth. And we felt that those pivots in the technology was critical to achieve that goal. Mm-hmm. While it requires an amount of capital investment, not doing it is probably a more surefire bet that they will run into problems in the future, which will prohibit them from being able to achieve his main goal, which is to be able to pass it on to Sixth.
Okay.
The most important thing is, even if Sixth isn't the CEO, he's going to retain ownership of the company. And let him be the lead sales guy, because that's what it seems like he's good at.
And we also mentioned that if he didn't agree with all this stuff, George Marks would probably have to leave.
Okay.
And that might be an incentive.
All right.
Freddie, you hit it right on. That's everything we agreed. You hit it right on the button.
Thank you. Great, good. Glad my memory is working, even as we have our unique drinks.
So, Ira. Is Ira here? Ira Jackson?
He's here, but we nominated Robin to
okay.
represent.
F- Fine.
Robert and myself.
All right. Where's
Yes, we lost Robert. Okay. So Ira jumped in if I'm missing anything. So we discussed that Fitz is obviously a risk-averse personality. But the facts tell us that he does share his son's concern about the company's niche evolving technologically. So we took the approach that the father might not necessarily be completely opposed to the idea of making the investment, just need to be coaxed a little bit in the right direction. We thought because it seemed it was such a small family-driven board, and we've been told that the father's sister and him have a caustic relationship, that perhaps bringing in an independent third party as sort of a management consultant might be advantageous. We thought that George should sort of leverage his prior experience as their business advisor to tell Fifth that in fact he was recommending that he speak to whoever Fifth finds as an appropriate management consultant to talk about the industry and the way it is developing one-on-one, but strongly suggests that Fifth bring the sister into the mix when the presentation is made by the management consultant and to step away from the family dynamics, just to tell him in his role as CEO, he should make the decision about listening to a third party management consultant to make the decision, but the whole board should have the benefit of hearing what the advice would be.
Okay.
We really didn't spend a lot of time talking about Dave Smith, the corporate counsel at all. We felt that he was sort of a puppet of the existing CEO, and we didn't think that he really added much to the situation. We had comments about the son, the fact that the father was an MIT graduate, his aunt was described as a successful lawyer, and that he did not complete college. And so that even though the father didn't necessarily disagree with the fact that they needed to make an investment, the father and the aunt probably needed a third party to support the views that the son was bringing to them, because they probably had doubts and maybe didn't respect him enough. And then the last point that I wanted to highlight was that Ira made a point of saying, and I have to say I completely missed this, that the company has a responsibility to the town. We talked about the length of time in the town, the fact that it trained people in the town, and that something that could be compelling to Fifth, the current CEO, is that it's not just his company that might eventually go out of business if he doesn't invest, but that the town is going to be losing a valuable employer, and that they have a responsibility that's bigger than just the company themselves.
Okay, interesting. Let me do one more. Doug Ferguson, how about you and your group?
Sure. I think one of the things that we looked at the questions at the end of the case, so, you know, him asking whether or not he should be an aggressive change agent, we kind of thought that he was woefully unprepared for the role that he stepped into, and that a charitable interpretation might be that he was awfully naive, and a more insidious interpretation might be that he was set up. First of all, you'd have to wonder why they brought in somebody who's into the situation who doesn't have any leverage to speak of. He's not an investor. He doesn't have a whole lot of substance based upon the business that he's bringing to bear. So why is he there? And what influence could he possibly have? So, you know, it didn't smell right to us at all. And that he isn't set up for success, and he didn't set himself up for success. So he personally is not in a position to be an aggressive change agent, we didn't think. So I think we sort of started with the context and said that he was over his head.
All right, well, let me take your issue and raise it in a more general way. Have any of you ever been in the situations where you were in a family-dominated business and you kind of felt you were there as window dressing?
Yes, I have, but I think that was sort of what, you know, part of we were concerned about is that, you know, whose foil were you? And I use the example area of, you know, there's an old expression about a poker game. When you sit down at a poker game and you can't figure out who the sucker is within the first 10 minutes,
it's you.
It's you. Right? And so this just didn't smell right.
Fred, have you been in this kind of situation where you were brought into a family business and...
Yes, I was. I was in a business where it was a husband and a wife running the company. The wife was the CEO and 100% owner of the company because they wanted to be classified as a minority owner company. And I'm not saying it's the right thing, it's just the situation. And they had completely different point of view on how to run the businesses. And I had to deal with people crying in the room, in the boardroom that we had to meet. And it was not easy.
I think Dorian had raised his hand. Have you been in a situation like this? Can you unmute yourself, Dorian? I can't seem to do it.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, can hear you now.
Yeah, so, the discussion around what George should do really brought us to that exact point. George was probably not gonna have to stay on the board unless he can make that board function in a family environment. He probably doesn't know that because of his experience though. So, or lack thereof. Part of the discussion that we had really focused at putting ourselves into his shoes. And what can he become an aggressive change agent? No, not under the circumstances, not without a functioning structural board. Does he know enough how to convince the family to do that? Well, let's assume he does. How does he go about it? Is by proposing not only a more robust board process, but really a board of advisors or board of directors to help this company with. And the case was very nicely written because it left a lot of room for interpretation relative to the size, the number of employees. I mean, if these people are penny pinching for $150,000 in development, what can they really afford in terms of a board, and do they know enough to do that? Have I been into this situation? Yes, as a CEO when I left the company, because I was not going to sit there and be window dressing. But, you know, at the end of the day, George really needs to make a decision whether to stay and continue to get frustrated or to put in place and help bring about a board with the right expertise, both in dealing with family business succession issue, which is what this really is about, as well as having somebody that understands the market and the evolution, you know, by your expression, Larry, the chief learning officer, which is woefully missing in this situation. So I'll stop here. Fred, Ellen, did I miss anything of what we talked?
Ellen, can you, I'm trying to unmute you. I can't seem to do it. Can you unmute yourself? Ellen, yeah.
Yeah, I'm unmuted. Look, I think I was with Frederick and Dorian, and they both have already contributed, so I don't have anything particular to add to it. We just had a very robust conversation about sort of what do we think George knows about what his role is supposed to be, and then given the ownership structure, what can he really impact, and which is heavily dependent upon the two owners, right? Yeah. So we spent a lot of time, and I don't want to repeat what Frederick and Dorian have already said, because they said it all very well.
Anybody else been in a situation, a family business situation kind of like this, and or another, or maybe a successful family business situation? Anybody? Okay, I see Raphael.
Go ahead, Raphael.
I was in a family business, fourth generation, and we had the best technology available at the time, yet it wasn't good enough. And when EPA came in, we signed a consent decree, $350,000 fine, and a $5 million license to operate with a closed-loop system. And I said to my uncle, the EPA also said, all officers will take a 20% haircut in compensation, no dividends and no bonuses. And since I control the bulk of the sales, I said, I'm not happy about this, but I'll go along with this solely on the basis that we become a low-cost producer. And the marketplace had changed. We thought we produced and made a product, but it was merchandise as a commodity. And if we weren't going to be a low-cost producer, we'd be gone, especially with additional debt service. So I tried a hostile takeover, and I got a boot in my butt. I was correct. Unfortunately, the family business did fail, not as quickly as I thought, but they had no idea. And it goes back to the point, what is the purpose of the business? If you don't take care of the customer demands, you won't be selling product. You can't pay your employees. You cannot pay yourself. You cannot pay yourself the excess compensation and perks that you may be taking out of the business. And it serves no purpose. And my thought was, I had met someone from the PDA years back, Dennis Kessler, whose tagline in the family business is taking them from the stuck to the unstuck. And you really need to bring in today in multi-generational businesses a family psychologist. What is the purpose of the firm? Get everybody around the table. Let's separate the family issues from the business issues. And once we understand where we want to go, then you can implement a game plan and how to get there.
Anybody else have, you know, let me just come to the end of this. Jerry said that in the end, the company did not invest in the technology, but in the end, it was found that the technology that they were going to invest in wouldn't have worked anyway. So it became a moot point. And in the end, the company did not thrive and had to be sold at a loss. And Jerry was the person who was on that board. I have been in situations where it's a third generation family business in technology and they're behind in technology. And the board is wrestling with, do they invest the money in R&D just to stay afloat? The problem in family businesses is to invest in the technology means no dividends for Aunt Jane, who needs that money to live on in her retirement community. So it's a very personal, painful decision that, you know, when you're in a private equity or a public company or a non-family business, it doesn't have that kind of acute issue. But let me throw over the question. If somebody was going to invite you to join the board of a family business, what questions would you ask? Because you don't want to end up like this guy in this case. What questions should you be asking?
Who's really in charge?
Okay, so I'm the CEO. I am. What's your next question?
Why do you want an independent board member?
Okay, why do you want an independent board member? Why am I interested if you're in charge?
Okay.
Exactly. Why are you asking me to join? What do you need from me?
I want outside perspective.
What are the current challenges that you're facing, and what's the tension between the CEO and the board?
Okay. That's a great question.
I think I might have answered if you told me you wanted an outside perspective is just to pay me as an advisor, because then I wouldn't have to feel like I had to get an outcome as a director and have the responsibility, the legal responsibility.
But your reputation would be on the line.
Yeah, I mean, your reputation would be on the line, sure. But, you know.
I'd ask, what are the financial interests of the different generations in the business? I really want to know, are they in alignment, or do they disagree about what they need financially and what they're looking to get for out of the company?
I don't want to be advertisement for Phil Holberton here, but Phil runs a Vistage Group, and one of the questions I would be asking the CEO is, how open are you to change? And of course he'll say, very open. I'll say, well, would you join a CEO group outside the family business? It could be Vistage, it could be Young Presidents Organization, could be something else. But to me, what I'm looking for, if I'm going to be on a board with somebody, I want a CEO who's open to change. And I know a lot of CEOs will tell me whatever I want to hear. But if they will commit to being on some sort of outside board to get outside perspective, like Vistage, that would be very important for me in terms of signing on. CEOs that I know are extremely competent at telling me what I want to hear. Whether it's true or not is a different matter. Any other? I'll tell you another thing that I would recommend if any of you get involved in a family business in the future, and that is, on the day that you join, you write your resignation letter. And you leave it undated, and you say, I have a copy, and I'm giving you, Mr. CEO, a copy. The very moment you feel I'm not of value, I want you to date the letter and give it to me, and I'm out of here. But it also is true that the moment I feel I'm just wasting my time, I'm going to date my copy of the letter, give it to you, and I'm out of here. I think what I find with family businesses, particularly, is if you don't make significant changes within 3 years, then you become part of the problem. And so you need to take a very strong position at the front end. Also, if you become part of the problem, then your reputation is on the line if this company falls down the tubes, because all the family will blame you. Other issues related to family businesses.
Now, Larry, would you ask at the outset, if you were to be retained as an outside director, would you ask what the D&O insurance entails and what the tails are?
Oh my God! Of course, but that's not just a family business issue. It is with anything. Then that includes nonprofits as well. Absolutely, and of course, the CEO will say this is adequate insurance, and of course the CFO is going to say that's adequate insurance, and of course I would take it to my own agent, an advisor, and get a second opinion about how adequate it is in 2020 with all this COVID stuff going around. And by the way, those of you who are on boards, it's not a bad thing to take your D&O insurance to some sort of, it could be your insurance agent, it could be your lawyer. Given what's going on in COVID, is the D&O still adequate? I mean, things are changing right before our eyes. So a D&O policy that might have been perfectly adequate 2 years ago, do you still believe it's going to be adequate today? And the answer is you don't know.
So how much do you bump your own umbrella?
The answer is I would get advice on that. I mean, right now we're dealing with very changing circumstances, and we just don't know. But so I would want to talk to a professional in the field. I certainly wouldn't rest on the assurances of the CEO that everything's okay. I want to get a second opinion. Anything else about doing work with family businesses?
Well, Larry, this is Phil.
Yeah.
And I think, Raphael, did you mention it about an organizational psychologist?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit in our group sometimes the business can't really solve the problems because there's so much conflict or emotion. And I have a couple of these companies now, unfortunately. And sometimes the emotions are bigger than the emotions are louder than the head. You know what I mean? The head doesn't think very well, but the emotions really drive the day. And so I think that's an important component in dealing with any of these things, is try to figure out what emotionally is going on with these two owners, and can that be diffused or solved over time? And perhaps it can't.
Yeah.
Well, Larry said it relates back to, you talked about Vistage or other peer groups. Many family businesses are so industry myopic. They have no idea of outside influences that could impact their businesses. They're focused on revenue, bottom line, and what they can take out. Nothing else.
I was making a plug for Vistage and you in terms of family businesses.
And I said in our group, which Carla was going to be our spokesperson, and I got a couple of these companies now, and it's father and son, and oh boy, it is brutal.
Yeah, they're extremely difficult. And the other thing to keep in mind is there are some well-known, highly respected, very, when you think of family businesses, it's not just your mom and pop operation. Fidelity is a family business. And I did some work for Fidelity, and it was fascinating, because the further away you get from the Johnson family, the more professional it is. And the more you climb up the hierarchy and get closer to the Johnson family, the more it's just your typical family business. Same issues that other family businesses have. So I found it fascinating. Speaking of fascinating, we will be meeting next month, same time, same place here. You can't say you can't find, you got lost.
But Craig had trouble getting on. He can't get his video on. We have to maybe do a trial.
Okay. Yeah. Marianne is going to be presenting a case, and it's really going to be, when I say torn from the headlines, it is really an up-to-date case. Helen is going to be able to relate to this case a lot. It deals with an assisted living facility, and the board having to sort of deal with, if we keep going the way we're going, we could go bankrupt. On the other hand, if we accept COVID-19 patients, we're putting our core people at risk. What are we going to do? It's a real dilemma, and it is a current dilemma faced by many boards. So we'll be dealing with that next month. So
Larry, before we sign off, can we ask the second generation of your family how the first meeting went?
Oh, Jenny?
Unmute yourself. You have to unmute yourself.
Yeah.
I am unmuted.
No, you did it.
Yeah, this has been great and fascinating, and Dad, you did a great job seamlessly navigating the Zoom breakouts, I thought. I thought it was a really interesting case, and interesting the different decisions that came up with the groups. So I enjoyed it.
Let me get some feedback from you all about the format. Was we did about an hour with three people, and the theory was, I wanted some time for you to be intimate with some people, rather than, you know, look at 27 other faces. Did that work? Was an hour too much, too little? What are your thoughts?
I think it's perfect.
Yeah, okay. It worked very well.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing, you know, we have some regulars here who've been like Mindy and Ellen, who've been to our programs in our regular office. You know, we would get 15, maybe 18 people, but we're getting far more people in this venue. So I'm inclined to think this is a pretty good setup.
And people are coming from other geographic areas, so that's important. They couldn't come into the other
right.
meetings.
Right, yeah, Dorian's from Vermont. I don't think he'd travel to Newton for...
I'm Jerry, too. I'm not the only Vermonter in this group here.
I came from New York, so...
I'm doing it in New York.
You're from Vermont, too, Ira?
I'm zooming in from Fire Island, New York. So.
Mm. Ah, good for you. Good.
George Peterson's from Sarasota, Florida.
Where? Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, that's right.
312 here. It's a beer as well as an area code.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you very much for joining us. We hope to see you next month at Seat at the Table. So I'll say goodbye. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. Good job. Good to meet everyone.
Good to meet everyone.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.